Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Mike, I've been practicing my back squatting. I just want you to give me some feedback on this.
Sure.
All right. So here's 80 kilos. Here we go.
Matthew, my fine sensibilities.
What's wrong?
I'm in shock, Matthew.
Do you have any tips?
Yes. Wear underpants. Welcome everybody to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's medical podcast. I am Dr. Mike Todorovic and I'm joined here with my co-host, Dr. Matt Barton. How are you, Matty?
I'm pretty sure you haven't done your research today.
We're doing shock, aren't we?
Yes, but that's the wrong type.
So it's not just being a Southern belle with fine sensibilities.
No.
Okay. I think we're doing
circulatory shock.
Okay. Should I define it?
I think that's a good start.
Okay. So shock is basically a reduction in blood pressure leading to a reduction in blood flow to the organs of the body. And this reduction in blood flow means not enough oxygen and nutrients gets to the tissues to feed them, and they become ischemic, hypoxic, and begin to die and can become necrotic.
Right.
And so shock is basically a clinical syndrome, and there's many different types of shock, which we'll go through today, but that's the basic overview.
So really the tissues of the body are just running out of blood.
Yeah, that's
therefore
right.
Therefore slowly dying.
Correct.
Okay, all right. Should we just quickly point out what we'll be following through today? Kind of a quick outline.
Yeah, structure. How do you want to do it?
All right, well, you've done the definition. I think we should then put some categories in terms of the causes of shock, so the etiology. Yeah. Then I think we should have a quick look at the physiology. So what's happening in the body on how kind of shock manifests. Then we will go to the stages of shock. And that's kind of a combination of how does your body react to try and keep you alive. But if it doesn't, it just kind of gets worse and worse until death ensues.
Yes.
And then we'll bring in Dinesh.
Yeah, so we'll have our physician in who works in the ED department at Gold Coast University Hospital, and he will be able to give us a very good update in regards to the current clinical management of shock.
And possibly ways of diagnosing in a manner, because we'll see shortly that there's different causes of shock, how you might be able to distinguish between those. Or even if that's useful, I'm not sure clinically. That's why we're bringing him in.
So how do you want to start? What do you want me to go through? Do you want me to start?
Well, we've done the definition. So do you want to now look at what are the main causes of why you get hyperperfusion? Is that the best kind of term? Hypoperfusion.
Hyperperfusion. Under
of tissue. Perfused.
Yeah, I think that's the way to do it.
And you said this earlier, Because you could have hypoperfusion of just your brain.
Yeah.
Or hypoperfusion of just your heart. Or hyperperfusion or just kidneys. But these aren't called shock. It's one would be called cerebral vascular accident, almost like stroke. One would be a heart attack and one would be acute kidney injury, or they used to call it acute renal failure.
Yeah, that's right. So shock is obviously systemic.
So it has to be
multiple tissues.
Multiple kind of organs at once. Okay.
And I think what it rests upon is the blood pressure equation. And so when we look at the blood pressure equation, blood pressure is equal to cardiac output times systemic vascular resistance. So it's a very simple equation. Now, if you know what cardiac output is, it's the amount of blood our heart pumps out per minute, and systemic vascular resistance, which you sometimes read in textbooks as total peripheral resistance, is simply the resistance that the blood encounters as it's moving through the vessels. Now, because some vessels of the body, specifically arterioles, have a lot of smooth muscle around them or within them, they can change their diameter. And if you think of a hose, if you were to have a more narrow hose, it's harder for the water to get through. Therefore, the resistance goes up. So reduce the diameter of a vessel, resistance goes up and things back up and backlog, and that increases pressure. So if you increase systemic vascular resistance, it's a simple equation, you increase blood pressure. The opposite happens when you dilate or relax that blood vessel. More blood can get through without resistance. Therefore, the resistance drops, blood pressure drops. So cardiac output is also a combination of two things, which is heart rate and stroke volume. Heart rate is how many times your heart beats per minute, and stroke volume is how much blood your heart ejects per contraction. Multiply those two together and you get cardiac output. So the reason why I'm saying this is because blood pressure is equal to heart rate times stroke volume times systemic vascular resistance. If you increase any one of those variables, you will increase blood pressure, and vice versa. If you decrease any one of those variables, you're going to decrease blood pressure. Whole point of bringing this up is because if blood pressure has dropped, you get hypoperfusion.
Right.
And so hypoperfusion is leading to that reduction in oxygen and nutrients. Tissues don't get fed. And this is a primary underpinning cause of shock. Does that make sense?
It does.
All right.
So I think we'll bring that back into play.
Yes.
Once we've gone through the main causes. Okay?
Sure.
So the way that the causes are generally demarcated is, well, it's done in different ways, right? So depending on the resources that you use, they might do things like cardiogenic, neurogenic, hypovolemic, sometimes obstruction, even different ones to that. But generally, it's broken down into hypervolemic, okay, obstruction, cardiogenic, and distribution issues.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what I thought we could do is go through an easier way to try and think of that. So do you want to explain a diagram that I showed you?
Yeah. So, Matt, now, obviously, it's really hard on a podcast to refer to a diagram, but I want you to picture in your mind just a container filled with blood. And that is your circulating blood volume. And so the main point here is blood volume. So I want you to think of A for amount here. So this is the first one. We're going to go through the A, B, C, D of shock,
yep.
Okay? Or at least the cause of shock.
Causes, yes.
All right, so A being amount, how much blood is floating around through your, or circulating through your body.
And that's about 5 to 6 liters, depending female, male.
Right? That's right. Five for female, six for male.
So like a bucket of blood. A, this is number A, sorry, letter A.
Jeez.
Letter A, and that means amount, okay?
Yep.
Now we're bringing a little tube to the heart, okay? So bring in the tube from the bucket to the heart, okay?
All right, so Matt's obviously made it more very complex.
Do you want to go to the causes of A at this point? Okay, all right.
Yeah, so
okay, sorry.
We've just got a bucket, right?
Okay.
It's filled with blood. And the next one is what we have is obviously vessels leading to the heart. So, and it's not just vessels, but it's going to be different structures associated with the heart or leading to the heart or surrounding the heart that can lead to a blockage or some sort of obstruction. So I want you to think of the heart's ability to work as a pump, right? Things can obstruct or block that. And so it could be some problem with the vessel. It could be some problem with the lungs, because we know that the lungs basically encase or surround the heart. And you've also got a little sac surrounding the heart as well. So think of B now for blockage, and it could be a multitude of things, but we will go through that in a second. C is going to be cardiac, and so I want you to refer to the heart. So now we're just thinking about the heart as a pump itself. And obviously, in order for heart to work as a pump, it needs to be able to contract. So muscle is important. The electrical conduction of the heart is important and so forth. When we look at D, which is the last one, this is going to be distribution. So this is going to be the vessels that distribute the blood around the body. And predominantly we're referring to arterioles here. And the reason why, not just arterioles, because we can also refer to capillaries as well, but arterioles have smooth muscle, so they can dilate and relax. And capillaries have little gaps or pores between them to let fluid out or back in as well. And so I want you to think about D for distribution. How do we distribute the blood? Now, what you can do, what Matt was alluding to, and I rudely interrupted him, was you can connect all these things up with some tubes. So for example, the bucket of blood, you can have a tube going from the bucket to the heart. And from the heart, you're going to have some tubes that go out to the tissues of the body. And now everything's linked up. A, for the amount of blood. B, for blockages around or associated with the heart. C, the heart itself. D, distribution of the blood around the body. And that leads back to the bucket too, right? So it's all linked up. Where do you want to go from there, Matt?
Okay, so we've illustrated the diagram. Now what we can do is go through A, B, C, D, and we can give examples for each. So
sure. And we're going to relate it back to the blood pressure equation, because that's the most important, in my eyes as a physiologist, that's the most important part.
So once we've gone through A, B, C, D and the examples that fit, then we'll bring it across to you to do your blood pressure.
Oh, okay. So Matt's telling me exactly where I fit.
No, I just don't want to
podcast.
Mix it up halfway through. That's all.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
You start.
So A, that's the bucket. This is the amount. This is the amount of blood in the system. As we said, approximately 5 liters for the females and 6 liters ballpark for males. Happy with that?
I'm happy.
Okay. All right. So in terms of amount, this really refers to hypovolemia, so a low volume of blood.
Okay. So you're saying that for shock to occur in relation to blood volume,
yep,
you have to have a low blood volume.
Correct.
And this is hypovolemic shock.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, so is it just blood we're referring to?
No, there's kind of a number of ways you can further categorize it. And I think the first category is either intravascular or extravascular causes.
Okay. So can I jump in here and just say, it's not just blood. It's not just a bucket of blood. It's a bucket of fluid in the body. So,
well, blood is got a lot of fluid in it. So 55% of your blood is plasma fluid.
All right. So
which is a bit of salty, sugary water, really.
Yeah. So let's reiterate and say it's a bucket of fluid. Now, I'm a 70-kilogram male, right? A very good-looking 70-kilogram male. That's besides the point. Doesn't need to be brought up, but it's a fact. I mean, why not? We should do a whole episode on it. All right, so 70-kilogram male, what you're going to find is that 60% of my body weight is fluid, which is about 42 liters. Now, of that 42 liters, 28 liters is intracellular within the cells of my body, and around about 14 liters is extracellular, outside the cells. Now, extracellular can be broken up into between the cells, what we call interstitial. But it can also be intravascular,
right,
which is what you're alluding to. Now, if we were to look at those volumes, intravascular, there's about 3 liters. So that's your 55% of my blood plasma, right? And extravascular is 11 liters. So this is interstitial. This is between the tissues of the body.
Great. That sets it up well, actually. So thanks for that.
Well, you're welcome. That's why I'm on the podcast as well.
All right. So we'll start off with the intravascular causes of shock through the hypovolemia category.
Okay.
Okay. So this is blood reasons, causes through blood problems or blood leaking.
Okay. Blood specifically.
Blood specifically, or whole blood, should I say. Okay. So you could have loss of whole blood externally. So for instance, trauma, if you were to be stabbed or shot, blood's just going to leak out of you.
Just leak straight out, like straight a tap. Out.
Yep.
So this is hemorrhage?
Yeah. So external bleeding.
Oh, okay. Trauma. Gotcha. Yep.
So this is, and then also you could maybe have GIT bleeds here where you are, let's say you've got varices.
Okay.
At the esophagus.
Ulcerations.
Or ulcerations like a peptic ulcer, and you're bleeding into your gut and then either poo in or vomiting it out.
All right. So okay? Loss of blood. Yep.
Externally. Okay. So now we go to internally bleeding. Okay.
Oh, so internal hemorrhaging.
Right. So this is where you might bleed into a space. For instance, you might bleed into your peritoneal cavity. An example would be a triple A. So an abdominal aortic an aneurysm. It busts and now bleeds into your abdominal cavity. But you don't see it come out. It's just within a cavity.
So the aorta is a pretty big blood vessel, isn't it?
Yeah, very big.
Coming straight out of the heart, filled with oxygen and nutrients. That bursts. Obviously, the tissues aren't getting that oxygen and nutrients. It's your potential, your abdomen is getting that.
Yep.
Okay.
Another example you could think about is an ectopic pregnancy. So this is where implantation occurs in, the fallopian tube instead of the uterus, and it kind of ruptures, and now you have bleeding, presumably either into the peritoneum or maybe into the uterus, and then that's concealed, but there's still a bleed.
So where would something like postpartum hemorrhage be?
Probably the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, same thing. But this is probably coming out of the uterus, vagina, externally. So
all these types of losses of blood, all these causes for losses of blood can lead to hypovolemic shock.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah. And then finally another one of just blood loss as an example. You could also have retroperitoneal bleeding, and this where like goes into like behind the peritoneum and just bleeds into a space there as well. And an example could be the aneurysm in the abdominal aneurysm.
Okay.
So instead of breaking and bleeding forward into the peritoneum, it could bleed and break or go backwards
because of specific branches
or just where it's located. Sometimes some blood vessels are located behind the peritoneum, so it will bleed behind, which I guess would make it more challenging for to find where that bleeding is.
Okay. All right. So this is all blood.
This is all blood.
But like you said, the body's not just filled with blood.
Correct. So now we can go to plasma losses. So,
oh, okay.
So this is still intravascular. So it's still the blood products, but this is specifically the salty water component. Okay. So a good example here is burns. So third degree burns. You're losing a lot of the plasma fluid of blood, and it's just leaking out of the body because you've lost your integrity of your skin. Okay. Another example could be excessive sweating or dehydration. Okay. Another condition could be ascites, where you've got a problem with your liver and it puts too much pressure in your portal vein, and then it pushes the plasma out into your peritoneum and you're losing a lot of fluid into the peritoneum. Examples would be liver failure.
So like that. So could edema be part of this?
Yeah, yeah. But this is a type of edema, but specifically edema in the peritoneum.
Okay. Yep.
And then finally, another good example of plasma loss would be pancreatitis. And so this is where the pancreas is kind of digesting
eating itself.
But probably, because as you know, the pancreas releases a lot of enzymes to break down food, one of them being for proteins. And if you're spilling that around your abdominal contents or around your organs, you're going to start generating a whole lot of inflammation.
Mm.
A lot of fluid's going to go into the area, and then you're going to lose the plasma from that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's all intravascular causes. Now we go to extravascular causes.
Okay. Are you all right with words today?
But still in hypovolemia.
Okay.
Okay. So two good examples of ways you can lose fluid extravascularly is GIT. So this would be excessive vomiting, excessive diarrhea. Okay. If you've got bowel obstruction, that could also lead to fluid loss extravascularly. And this is probably decreasing the way the absorption capacity in the gut, but also it's probably going to draw fluid into that area as well. And that's going to result in loss.
All right.
And then finally, renal causes. So this is where if you had, DKA, so ketoacidosis, or maybe just unmanaged forms of diabetes where you urinate in it. Heap.
And so this is an osmotic cause where you've got a lot of glucose in your bloodstream. It gets pulled out via the kidneys and it pulls water with it.
Yeah. Matt's I just lost water.
Yep. That's the second time he's actually dropped his glass filled with water. So good job, Matt.
That fits well with the.
So Matt spilled his water. There we go. So Matt's hypervolemic on the floor. So we've gone.
It's all hypovolemia. So all different things,
ways we can lose that fluid.
Yeah, that's right. So okay. They're all the most common ways you could develop hypovolemic shock, which is from the bucket.
All right.
Happy with that?
Well, relatively.
All right. So let's now move on. How do you get blood from that bucket to the heart? And this is B for blockage.
Okay.
Okay. So this is now conditions or causes that result in the way that the blood gets to the heart all around the heart.
Yeah.
Okay. These are sometimes called obstruction shock.
Okay.
So I've just got three here. We don't have to really do much more than this. Tension pneumothorax.
Yeah.
So this is really where one lung collapses, but collapses in a way where there's so much positive pressure in your pleural cavity, it starts to force that lung to the opposite or the contralateral side.
Yeah. So if everyone remembers from the respiratory system, you've got your lung tissue and you've got a pressure inside that lung tissue, which is on average equal to the atmosphere, but the lung tissue is surrounded by a little cavity called the pleural cavity, which is negative in pressure. Now, the pleural cavity is negative in pressure so the lungs can stick to it and so that the pleural cavity can also stick to the thoracic cavity so that when you use the muscles for breathing to expand that thoracic cavity, the lungs move with it because negative pressures suck, right? But if you have some sort of stab wound which pierces or penetrates the pleural cavity, you open up a hole in the pleural cavity, and because it's a negative pressure and there's a hole there, air rushes down its pressure gradient from high to low. So air is going to rush into the pleural cavity and it expands. And this expansion of the pleural cavity is what's shifting the lungs, and it can shift the trachea and it can shift what's called the mediastinum, which is the space that...
Mediastinum.
The mediastinum. I say mediastinum.
I know.
Does that matter?
No.
Is it the same?
Guess so.
I don't know. Tomato, tomato, potato, patootie. So it pushes the heart to the side.
Yeah. By doing that, it can compress the heart, so that decreases the ability of the heart to pump out blood, but it can also put pressure or compress the big vessels going into the heart, like the vena cavas.
So this is the blockage or obstruction.
Yep, yep.
So you're not pneumothorax.
So you're not getting blood from that bucket to the heart because of that tension pneumothorax.
Tension pneumothorax. Okay, so that's one. What's the second one?
There's another one called pericardial tamponade, which essentially kind of means pressure on the heart from the outside. So your heart is surrounded by a sac, a pericardial sac, which is quite strong and fibrous to give it some degree of protection.
Yep. It also releases a fluid so that when the heart, because obviously the heart's going to beat every couple of seconds or every second, and when it beats, it shifts, it moves. Yep. And so it doesn't rub or cause friction. It's in a sac that releases a lubricating fluid.
Yep.
And so
there's no friction, yeah.
So there's no friction. But
it's a tough sack.
Yes.
So it's similar to, say, your skull, which means if things start to build up inside that sack, the area that will get compressed is the softest part. So like in your brain, if you had a bleed, your brain will get compressed. Same thing here. If you get a bleed around your pericardium, it's going to start compressing on the heart tissue. And that means also the heart can't feel, but also push out.
Or in addition to that, if you have something called pericarditis and inflammation of the pericardial sac, or at least some layers of the pericardial sac, we all know that inflammation always leads to increased fluid production, right?
Yeah.
It just happens. And so the fluid can accumulate in the pericardial sac and result in the pericardial tamponade.
So this would be if you ruptured a coronary artery and it bled, it will just then start accumulating in that space, and then eventually your heart can't feel, can't expand, and that would be the obstruction.
Okay.
Finally, another one would be a pulmonary embolism. So this is where you have a big clot that would, let's say, break off from an iliac vein, go all the way up your inferior vena cava, go through your right atrium, go through your right ventricles because they're big chambers, and then go up through the pulmonary trunk, and then somewhere along there gets blocked. Therefore, what happens is there's no blood continuing to the left side of the heart, or there's such a high amount of pulmonary tension or blood pressure, it reduces preload.
Gotcha.
And so the heart's not filling.
The filling of the heart. Yet. Okay.
So they're the main obstructive causes or blockage causes.
Yeah, B for blockage. So we did A for amount, that's the volume of fluid in the body. B for blockage or obstruction. And now we're at the heart itself, so C for cardiac.
Yep, and these is what we call cardiogenic shock causes. Right. Or cardio meaning heart, genic means to generate, right?
Well, no, it's Genesis. the origin. So it's originating at the heart. So, So shock is originating at the heart. And we know that the heart is a pump. That's what it does. It needs to pump blood. And so cardiogenic shock, anything that stops the heart working as a pump is going to be cardiogenic shock.
Yep.
Like what?
Okay, so I've got three kind of subcategories here. One being a decreased contractility, one being decreased filling, and one being arrhythmias.
Okay.
Okay, so decreased contractility, this means the efficiency of the heart beating. Okay. By far the most common example here would be a myocardial infarction or a heart attack. You stop blood going to the heart muscle itself, it will start dying. Therefore, the heart is not being efficient anymore. Therefore, you're not going to get good output or contractility of the heart. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Another example is the cardiomyopathies, like dilated cardiomyopathy, which is a floppy heart. Yeah. And another one is myocarditis, which would be, like you said, inflammation. But in this case, it's the inflammation of the myocardium, again, losing its ability to contract as a muscle.
Okay.
All pretty straightforward?
Pretty straightforward. Yeah, it's a muscle. And if it doesn't contract properly, blood doesn't inject properly. If blood doesn't inject properly, blood pressure drops. All right, okay. I got it.
Another subcategory is decreased filling. So that just means the heart can't preload. It can't load itself with blood. A good example would be something wrong with the right ventricle, like an MI just in the right ventricle. That means the right ventricle's not pushing blood across to the left. Therefore, it's not preloading. Therefore, there's nothing coming out of the heart.
Okay.
Okay. You might have some valve issues as well that could cause this. And then finally, arrhythmias. That's pretty straightforward. So a problem with
conduction issues.
Yeah. And so some good examples would be VT, so ventricular tachycardia, is beating so quick that it's not having any time to fill. So nothing's coming out of it.
Yeah, that's an important point because when we go to the blood pressure equation to talk about all these things, which I would have liked to have done while we're talking about it, but that's okay.
I think that's a bad plan.
Okay. No problem. But when you think about the ways you can increase blood pressure, because the equation has heart rate times stroke volume times systemic vascular resistance, you'd think that increasing heart rate would increase blood pressure. And it's true up until a point. Because if you increase heart rate, you increase how much blood gets ejected. And that obviously makes sense. But the heart needs to fill between every ejection. And so if it beats too quickly, it's going to contract before it's fully filled with blood and it won't eject enough. So the ejection fraction can reduce the higher the heart rate goes. And if you become tachycardic, then obviously the ejection fraction is so low that your blood pressure drops even further. And that's an important point, which a lot of students in exams neglect because the equation is simple and that's true, but up until a point.
Yeah. And you can go on the other end of the spectrum here and go into a really slow heartbeat, a bradycardia. And that would be so slow that the heart rate's so slow that it's not pushing enough blood out.
Yeah, and you can, you know, there's always exceptions to the rule, and you can think of athletes, for example. So instead of their heart beating 70 odd times a minute, they can beat, you know, lower than 50 times a minute. And so you think, oh, since the heart rate's gone down, the blood pressure will go down, but it's just a thicker muscle tissue. And so it's a stronger contraction, and therefore blood pressure is maintained. Yep.
And then finally, you might have some problems with the atria, like atrial fibrillation, where it's just like a bowl of jelly and it's not pushing any blood down into the ventricles. So again, it's a preload issue there.
Yep.
So that's it for the C for cardio.
So we've done hypovolemic shock, obstructive shock, and cardiogenic shock. A, B, C.
So now we're left with D.
Distributive.
So this is really now taking blood to the organs. Okay, so the three main ones I'll just discuss here are septic shock, neurogenic shock, and anaphylactic shock.
Yeah.
Or you've got inflammatory shock.
Yes.
So, actually that's inflammatory for the septic shock.
Yeah.
So this is basically, there's a problem with the vasculature that's bringing blood to the actual organs, which probably becomes dilated, and now your blood pressure drops through the vascular resistance. And so the organs that you really need to be perfused aren't getting perfused anymore. And then that's leading to shock. So septic shock is through an infection. So your immune system's reacting so severely to that infection, like a bacteria infection. Sometimes bacteria can release exotoxins. Sometimes when bacteria die, this is more gram-negative bacteria, they can release a intrinsic factor within their membrane called an endotoxin, which can also cause...
Lipopolysaccharide?
Yep, which can also result in a reaction in the immune system that could lead to these blood vessels to go super big. Okay, anaphylactic, we've spoke about before. I think we spoke about this when we did inflammation, but essentially what's happening here is you're releasing so many amounts of...
pro-inflammatory chemicals.
Particularly histamine. And we know that histamine is really good for causing vasodilation to an inflamed area. We saw that, let's say, in hay fever. But if this is body-wide, that means all your blood vessels are now super dilated. So that means the distribution of blood to areas that you really want it is now poor.
So let me just reiterate. So when we look at this distributive type of shock, you can see that there's septic shock and that there's, which is an inflammatory-based shock, and anaphylactic shock, which is also an inflammatory-based shock. Now, septic shock, like Matt said, is usually some sort of invading pathogen that our body has a reaction to, and anaphylactic shock is some sort of usually innocuous antigen or protein that our body reacts to as well. So they're both over or hyperexcitability or a hyperreaction of the immune system. And so as we know, because we've done an immune system podcast and we've done an inflammation podcast, you know that when these things happen, we release those pro-inflammatory chemicals like histamines, like leukotrienes, like prostaglandins. And we know, like Matt said, they dilate blood vessels, they make them wider. So like I said, this is playing around with systemic vascular resistance. Make them wider, blood pressure drops. But they also increase vascular permeability, so fluid leaks out. All right, and so again, blood pressure drops. But there's a third type of...
Can I just add something to septic shock? They used to call this blood poisoning.
Yep.
And some good examples of how you could get this is like peritonitis. So you have an inflammation in the peritoneum because that's a lot of tissue. You could get rupturing of your gastrointestinal tract, and that would spill out essentially poo into your abdominal cavity, and that's got a lot of bacteria in it. That's going to cause a lot of problems. Mm. Any kind of gangrene tissue, and another good example is like a UTI that's then got put into the blood.
Okay.
So these are some of the most common examples of how you might develop septic shock.
All right.
Sorry, what was your...
I was just going to say there's a third type
of
this distributive shock, and that is neurogenic. So just like we had cardio...
Is that what you had when I was doing the squat?
Yes, I had neurogenic shock. So this is a nervous system issue. So just like cardiogenic, it's originating at the heart. This is weight. It's originating at the nervous system. Don't you love it when Matt decides to interrupt while I'm speaking?
So do you think I get that?
Don't you hate it when he interrupts while I'm speaking?
When I vomit, do you think I get neurogenic shock very short?
Just so everyone knows.
Hence why I collapse?
Just so everyone knows. When Matt gets gastro... I'm yet to see it, but when Matt gets gastro, for example, and he needs to vomit, he wakes up a few seconds later on the floor. So he has what I wouldn't say it's neurogenic shock.
No, because it's not.
You don't have hypoperfusion.
It's neurogenic caused, right?
Yes, it's vasovagal.
It's just not a shock. But if that continued, yes. I would then get shock, right?
Correct. So yeah. Neurogenic is basically a vasovagal issue.
Yeah.
So vasovagal simply mean the vagus nerve playing around with the blood vessel diameter. And that's what's happening with neurogenic shock. It's predominantly individuals with spinal cord injury, usually above T6, mostly in the cervical area.
Or certain drugs. Like anesthesias and stuff. Yeah.
Damaging the blood vessels, damaging those sympathetic fibers. So sympathetic fibers like to travel to certain blood vessels of the body, specifically the peripheral blood vessels, and tell them to constrict. And when they constrict, your blood pressure goes up because it's increasing systemic vascular resistance. But if you have a spinal cord injury, like I said, above T6 and it damages sympathetic fibers, you have the parasympathetic fibers, which are the flip side of the coin, and they go unchecked. Because as you should probably know, and if you don't, that's okay, but sympathetic, parasympathetic work in tandem. So when one goes up, other goes down, and they balance each other out constantly throughout the day. But if one goes down, the other one goes unchecked and it boosts up. And that's parasympathetic. Predominantly, it's going to be the vagal nerve. and that just dilates everything. Yeah. And if it dilates all these blood vessels, blood pressure drops. So it's not an issue with the heart. It's not an issue with the blockage. It's simply the blood, the neurons that are innervating blood vessels.
Yeah, cool. All right. It's A, B, C, D, shock.
All right.
Hopefully that helps.
Well, I hope so. Now what I want to do is I want to relate
it. You can take over.
Thank you. Finally. All right, everyone. Matt's given up. He's walking away. All right. So I think first thing is we need to relate it back to the blood pressure equation. So cardiac output and systemic vascular resistance. So first thing is, let's go back to A, which is hypovolemia, which is the amount of fluid in the body. So if somebody has hypovolemic shock, the blood volume has gone down. This one's easy. It means cardiac output is down. But specifically, it's stroke volume is going down. So I want you to think about the equation now, right? So blood pressure needs to be maintained. Your body is always in homeostasis. So if something tries to kick you out of whack, your body will respond in order to bring it back into homeostasis. So you got the blood pressure equation, stroke volume goes down. That means if both heart rate and systemic vascular resistance don't change, blood pressure goes down. But they don't want blood pressure to go down, so they have a response. And that's going to be an increase in heart rate. So if somebody has hypovolemic shock, they may come in tachycardic. Mm. Their heart rate may be through the roof to try and balance out their drop in blood pressure. Or they may also have a constriction of the blood vessels to try and increase the blood pressure, which often is the peripheral blood vessels shunted away from the skin to the organs that need it. And what we end up having is cold limbs.
Yeah, cool, clammy.
That's right. Yep. So that's hypovolemic. Now, body tries to do it to compensate. These are compensatory mechanisms, and often they're not sufficient. Next stop, did you want to add anything?
Oh, the only other things I could add here, you've done a good job.
Could or should?
No, it's just additional things that could be tested clinically. So sometimes they may want to test the jugular venous pressure or even the pressure coming into the left atria. And these pressures would be down in hypovolemic shock because, as you said, the blood return into the heart is low. And so therefore, those pressure values are going to be low as well.
Okay. Then we're going to look at obstructive shock. So Matt said the tension pneumothorax, we've got the tamponade, and we've also got, what was the last one? Oh, a PE, pulmonary embolism. Okay. So what's going to happen here is it's an obstruction, and the obstruction can alter, what do you think?
This would be almost the same as hypovolemic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because it's just not getting the blood returning to the heart.
So the way I see it is it's not specifically heart rate. It's not specifically stroke volume. It's specifically cardiac output issues. So I would say cardiac output itself has dropped. And so one of the main ways that the body's going to respond is increase in systemic vascular resistance and, again, constriction of those blood vessels. So not necessarily an increase in heart rate, but necessarily a constriction
I think you could almost guarantee that almost in all forms of shock at the compensatory level, you would get a tachycardia.
Even with obstruction because it's wrapping around the heart?
Yeah, well, it's still because we'll get to this, but essentially the way that the body's just trying to compensate here is it's picking up a low blood pressure regardless of any of these causes. You're going to still have a low blood pressure. And the baroreceptor effect is to tell the brain, hey, brain, we've got a low pressure here. Can you deal with this? And a fairly non-specific reaction is just to say, speed up heart.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then we go to cardiogenic. So this is cardiac output as well, an issue. So it can be either heart rate. It can be either stroke volume. And we've spoken about all those different types of cardiogenic shock. So again, increased systemic vascular resistance. And so, for example, if you've got a bradycardic issue or a tachycardic issue resulting in hypovolemia, it's not going to trigger an increase in heart rate because your heart rate's already through the roof, right? So the main way it's going to try and respond to this or compensate is through systemic vascular resistance increase. And that's one of the big ones when it comes to cardiogenic shock. The cold clammy is a big sign for cardiogenic shock.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Yeah. And then we look at the distributive. So neurogenic. So this is predominantly, so what we've just spoken about with hypovolemic, obstructive, and cardiogenic are all pretty much cardiac output sides of the equation. But the systemic vascular resistance end of the equation is neurogenic and the two inflammatory, which is septic and anaphylactic. And it makes sense because in all these three scenarios, the blood vessels are simply dilated. Systemic vascular resistance drops. And so again, the compensatory mechanism is jump over to the cardiac output end of the equation and try and increase heart rate, increase stroke volume. You okay with that?
Yeah. And so by doing that bigger dilation, the one big difference with the distribution shock is that the peripheries might actually be warm because they're getting more of a flow.
Good point. So the compensation, like we spoke about earlier, for the cardiac output end, you've got cold clammy. But in this end, and it's cold and clammy because the blood vessels, particularly the peripheral blood vessels, constrict, shunt the blood away from the skin. Here, the actual problem is that the blood vessels are dilated at the skin, at the peripheries, at a lot of the tissues. And so, yeah, being warm or flushed can be one or a particular
patchy,
type of rash.
Mottled.
That's right. Yeah.
And sometimes with neurogenic, it could be quite dry because it's not only dilated, but also the sweat glands aren't being activated.
Yeah, good point. How's that? Now, when are we gonna have a chat with Dinesh about the clinical stuff?
I just want to go quickly through the how shock will progress.
Let's do it.
Just through the stages, and then we'll bring Dinesh on. So, in terms of what happens to the body as it's moving through these stages of shock, I found this really cool image. So, this is a diagram that kind of indicates what happens to the body in the early stages of shock. So,
isn't it great that he's got an image for all of you?
Well, I'm going to talk. Well, it's actually a figure, but
are you going to describe it in vivid detail?
Well, I'm just picking the book up.
Is that Guyton?
I'm not sure we could do advertising.
It's Guyton and Hall. Okay. Everyone knows Guyton and Hall, medical physiology.
Okay.
It's one of the best medical physiology texts.
All right. So,
what do you think about boron? Do you like the boron text?
It's a harder one to get into.
Harder one, I don't understand anything in the boron textbook.
Okay, so this diagram is looking at the body's effect in blood loss. So this is going to be more hypovolemic shock. So how is the body reacting, most notably cardiac output and MAP? Can you just quickly explain MAP?
Mean arterial pressure.
And how is that different to blood pressure?
Because it's the mean arterial pressure. So
rather than the fluctuations of systolic, diastolic, it kind of the average, is that right?
That's right.
All right.
Well, in a way, it's not necessarily, yes. Let's just say it's the average. Yeah.
All right.
But basically, it needs to be around about 90 millimeters. So we know that the top of our blood pressure is 120, right? And that's happening at the aorta.
Yep.
And then it drops all the way down to around about 50 or 30 at the capillaries. I always forget. I think at the kidneys, at the glomerulites, 50, and at the tissues.
That's 60, I think. 55.
Yeah, and at the tissues of the body, it's around about 30. But that's how the blood pressure drops as it distributes. Just like a hose, it's highest at the nozzle, it's lowest at the very end. That's how blood. But mean arterial pressure is, the way I think about it, it's the number is 90 millimeters of mercury, and this is the number required to maintain adequate perfusion to the tissues. So if it drops too low below 90 over a significant period of time, perfusion is not going to be adequate. Doesn't mean death, it just means not going to be adequate.
Yeah, okay, so I'll just mention the stages here. So there's a compensatory stage, which means you could go into shock, but your body has the ability with all its feedback mechanisms to bring you back to a state where you can recover. That's stage one, compensatory.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. Or sometimes a non-progressive. Number two is progressive, which basically means you're going into a stage where now you need an intervention, a clinical intervention, like an IV fluids or maybe some drugs to bring you back out. Whereas stage three, irreversible, this is... it's going to become
just
fatal.
Like the word says, it's irreversible.
It's going to end in a bad.
But do
outcome.
They all progress this way?
You know, or shock?
Because shock is acute or subacute. It's very quick.
Yep.
Right. So.
Oh yeah, but so if it's not rectified, it's going to end up in death.
Yeah.
So, this is an experiment. So back in the day, they did a lot of these shock experiments with animals. So I remember my professor that I did my PhD with, he said when he used to teach physiology back in the day, they would bring rabbits into the physiology class have an arterial line into it and some other diagnostic equipment like monitors for heart rate, ECG, all that stuff, blood pressure. And then they'll just start pulling blood out of the rabbit and look at the physiological response.
As in, are they conscious or unconscious? What happens to the heart rate?
I think the animal was anaesthetized, so it's it's not alive. It's not awake.
So just looking at the vitals.
That's right.
Okay.
And so this
is breathing, heart rate, things like that. Okay.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. So this is what I'm going to walk you through in terms of this diagram, which
I'll do it in the microphone for me.
Okay. So what's going to happen here is when we start to take blood out of the person by percentage. We're going to look at what the effect of cardiac output and MAP will be, okay? So if you remove 10% of your blood volume, so let's just say for a 5-litre person, okay?
Yeah, so for a 5-litre person, go on.
So this will be 500 millilitres.
All right.
Okay, if you took that out, that amount of blood, and this is about the blood amount of blood that a person would donate, right? So if you were to donate blood, it's about 500 mils. Maybe it's a touch under.
Yep.
There would be really little to no difference in cardiac output and MAP. It's pretty much holding at its 100% value.
So what you're saying is that our blood volume, there's a buffering capacity of around about 500 mils where...
About 10%.
About 10% of our entire blood volume where we maintain everything. We maintain mean arterial pressure. We maintain perfusion.
Cardiac output, yep.
Cardiac output. Right. Cardiac output will still be 5 liters a minute.
Yeah, something like that.
All right.
Okay, so now if you move up to 20% of blood volume, so you pull out 20% of the person's blood volume.
Microphone, Matt.
Okay, it's hard to look at both. Okay, again, MAP holds it pretty much at 100%. So if MAP is 20% doing well. Out. Yep.
So
but cardiac output's starting to drop.
Okay, so pressure's maintained, but the amount of blood coming out of the heart every minute has dropped. So we're still at around about 90 millimeters of mercury, which is good perfusion pressure. But cardiac output's dropped. So my assumption would be...
Maybe about the cardiac output's maybe about 75% of what it normally is.
So you may not know this.
You've pulled 1 liter of blood out of a 5 liter person.
Correct. And my assumption would be that the reason why mean arterial pressure is maintained is because maybe the heart's beating more slowly yet more powerfully.
Possibly. And the systemic vascular resistance will be much higher.
Okay, keep going.
And then we take off 30%. So this is now a liter and a half. Okay. Now arterial pressure's dropping. It's probably now to about 70%, whereas cardiac output's almost half now of what it should be.
Say that again.
So once you've taken 30% of blood volume out, the MAP is about 75% of what it normally is. Whereas the cardiac output's about half of what it normally would be.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then you bring it to 40% of blood of your total blood volume. Okay. And
now take that out.
Now it's in a lot of problems. So now you're pretty much getting to 30% on both MAP and the cardiac output.
So at what point, MAP-wise, are you having issues?
Okay. So I think the big problems start to arise once your MAP's kind of below 30 millimeters of mercury. So when a person goes into, say, a complete arrest where you've got no kind of output, the primary driver of what's trying to rectify this is the vasomotor component in your medulla. So this is a area of brain nuclei that is trying to tell the sympathetic nervous system to clamp down your blood vessels. And so that would be why the mean arterial pressure is probably more efficient than the cardiac output.
Yeah. Does that make sense? Systemic vascular resistance is coming into play.
But that's only going to be around for a bit. So if you maintain that real low amount of perfusion, then that part of the brain will die and then it's gone into irreversible stage.
So this is where the blood pressure equation really comes into action, because dropping out cardiac output, you're still maintaining pressure because you've got the compensatory mechanisms of systemic vascular resistance.
Yep.
All right.
So I'll just go through quickly what's happening in the body at each one of those three stages. Okay?
Okay.
So firstly, in the compensatory stage, this is where your body can bring it back on its own. Okay? So regardless of the type of shock, essentially what's going to be happening is you've got low blood pressure. Okay. And that's picked up. How does the body know it's got low blood pressure?
Baroreceptors, carotids.
Yep. And aortic arch.
Aortic arch.
They're the big ones. So they've got special pressure baroreceptors. Special. And they're getting taken back via the vagus and glossopharyngeal nerve to a part of the brainstem, which then tells the other part of the brainstem to say, please go speed up the
heart. Kick it up a bit.
Yeah. Hurry up heart, both in force and speed. Okay, so that's baroreceptors. Another one is the RAS system. So if your kidneys start to experience...
My favorite system, by the way.
Well, you quickly, in 2 minutes, explain what happens here.
So the RAS system is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. And what basically happens is this is all happening at the kidneys. And we know that kidneys need to filter the blood. And if the kidneys become hypoperfused, for whatever reason it may be, the kidneys need to try and maintain appropriate perfusion. So the kidneys respond because the blood vessel leading into the kidney that gets filtered, called the afferent arteriole, the pressure in that's going to be low. So it stimulates the kidney to release something called renin. And renin is going to activate something called angiotensinogen, which comes from the liver, which is floating around through the bloodstream, and turns into angiotensin. Angiotensin then turns into angiotensin 2 when it gets to the lungs, because the lungs produce an enzyme called ACE, angiotensin converting enzyme. And angiotensin...
which, as a side point, is where the COVID virus binds. Keep going.
Yes, but COVID binds to ACE 2, not ACE 1. Okay. So ACE 1, which is the one we're talking about here, increases blood pressure. ACE 2 inhibits it and drops blood pressure down. So ACE turns angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2, and angiotensin 2 does all the important blood pressure regulating things. So it constricts the efferent arteriole. It increases things like
I think just that's a lot of vasculature.
Vasopressin, which is also known as aldosterone, increases... No.
ADH,
sorry, antidiuretic hormone. So,
but it will tell aldosterone to be released, which causes salt retention, more water. So ultimately, the side effects, the good downstream effects from the RAS system is greater systemic vascular resistance and greater blood volume.
Correct.
Which will help with the blood pressure, hopefully in this shock, right?
Yep.
It'll also go to the brain and tell you to release ADH, which reabsorbs even more water, and it will tell you to be thirsty. So this could be an early sign of a person in shock. They're thirsty. Okay. Anything else? It's also going to help you to absorb more water in your gastrointestinal tract. So all this stuff in the compensatory stage of shock is really trying to get you the pressure back, the volume back, and the vascular to be
It's just trying to maintain homeostasis.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the take-home point for compensatory is it can be reversed on its own. Now we go into stage two, which is progression. So this is where you need an intervention to essentially save you. Now, part of the reason why a person is now getting worse, one of the big one is the cardiac depression. So your heart is now starting to give up the fight. Now, part of the reason why that is because as you've got a drop in MAP, that means also the coronary vessels aren't being perfused. And what are they supplying?
Blood.
Blood to the heart muscle.
Yeah.
That means the heart becomes weaker. That means the heart's not efficient anymore. That means the cardiac output's drop in. That means the MAP's drop in. Okay, other things that can go wrong in this stage is the vasomotor drive. From the brainstem.
I think we've broken Matt, everyone. I think this is ever spoken before, and I think he's now, going into shock, poor guy.
Other things that could be going wrong in this stage is because the tissue is getting such a poor blood supply, the blood is actually becoming sludgy and kind of clotty, and so this is also going to add to...
Clotty, everyone. Write it in your exam. Clotty.
And so this is actually what we see in some of the later stages in COVID, right, where the person's... their clotting mechanisms increased, and this is causing...
But I don't think it's due to this. I don't think it's due to hypoperfusion. I think it's due to von Willebrand factor.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
From all the inflammatory mediators being released?
I think so.
Okay.
It's for individuals who have a very specific von Willebrand response in regards to the clotting cascade.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then finally, another one just to be mindful of is the permeability of all your blood vessels becoming increased.
Yep.
So all your blood vessels are now leaky. And Michael just spilled his water too. So
that's three times we've spilt water during this episode. Two for Matt, one for me. We're not even yet.
Hypovolemia. So yeah, the permeability of all your blood vessels, because there's a whole lot of chemicals being released, like histamines and all those things, and therefore the vessels becoming so leaky, you're losing even more fluid, and this is part of the reason why you're now getting worse.
And well, what's the intervention? That's what you're talking about here, intervention.
Yeah, this is where Dinesh will come in.
Okay. But fluids, basically, right?
Yeah, fluids and vasoactive medications.
All right.
And then finally, we go into the irreversible stage. So this is basically your body, your tissue has been out of oxygen for so long. So oxygen, as we know, is very important for producing ATP, which is an energy molecule. And so what's happening at the cells, because they've been running out of oxygen or without oxygen for a longer period of time, their metabolic state shifts and they probably go more anaerobically, which means that they rely on other metabolites like creatine phosphate. I'm looking at you to try and get you to help here.
You're talking, buddy.
ATP starts to deplete. We move into ADP, but you also deplete that. AMP.
All right, let me explain. Yeah. Let me explain. So when you do... Okay, so if you've got oxygen and enough oxygen to produce energy, that's aerobic respiration, and you use that oxygen and you use a byproduct of glucose or glucose metabolism called pyruvate to basically produce a whole bunch of ATP molecules, 32 to 36 ATP molecules in this process. If you need to produce energy but you don't have enough oxygen, then what happens is you can't do this aerobic respiration, you have to do anaerobic. And what happens is the pyruvate backs up and turns into something called lactate. And at the same time, you produce hydrogen ions, but you also produce ATP. But it's a very inefficient method to produce that ATP. Now, the thing is this, we have very low stores of ATP within our body, but we've got high stores of ADP for whatever particular reason. And the amount of ATP we have in regards to exercise, for example. So if you went to do a sprint, you'd have probably 5 seconds worth of ATP in your muscle stores to use. But luckily, we've got something called creatine, which can bind to spare phosphates, right? And so when you run out of that ATP, it snaps off the phosphate to create the energy and turns into ADP. Those ADP stores can be replenished with phosphate by the creatine phosphate. And then you've got ATP again. So creatine and creatine supplementation simply gives you more energy. That's a very basic way of looking at it. Now, when we're looking at things like shock, we don't have any oxygen coming in. We don't have much nutrients coming in. We've got to utilize what is left and remaining, especially in significantly progressed states of shock. And the ATP that's available and the creatine phosphate that's available become depleted. So ATP turns to ADP, adenosine diphosphate, and you've only got two. But then you can take two ADPs and produce another ATP and an ADP and an AMP.
Which is monophosphate, just one phosphate now.
And then over time, you've just got AMPs and now you've just got monophosphates, and then over time, you're just going to be left with adenosines. And an adenosine is a purine. So you've got pyrimidines and purines, and they both undergo various types of metabolism. Now, adenosine, you know, you've got guanine and adenosine, right? Adenosine leaves the cell. But because it's a purine, it's basically the core of a purine. It's what is a purine. It undergoes purine metabolism, which is basically turning into urea or uric acid. And what happens from there?
Well, probably also because your kidneys aren't working, you've lost the ability to clear this.
Yes.
And so your uric acid would start to build up. And
because it's an acid, what does that mean?
And the lactic acid, which I guess is debatable now. But you have a whole lot of acids. Plus
microphone, Matt.
Plus your CO2 is increasing because your flow to take the CO2 away is poor. So you've got all these acids building up. So you're developing metabolic acidosis. And so this is now putting you in a really terrible shape. And this is part of the reason why it's irreversible. So even if you loaded the person up with volume, so through IV fluid and so forth, you might get back a blood pressure or MAP or an output that seems good, but because all the tissues are in failure now, particularly the heart, once you start to remove that intervention, the heart's just given up.
And you've got no ATP left.
Yeah.
You've got none of that adenosine to be able to reconstitute with phosphate. And it's going to be very difficult to give the body enough time to reconstitute that those ATP stores. Because you can't really just inject ATP into people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All right, Matty.
So that's it.
That's
it. We can now move on to the expert. Dinesh has been quiet in the corner. He hasn't actually spoken at all today. So I think it's time to bring him in. So Dinesh, we've got a couple of questions for you around the clinical aspects of shock. So firstly, in terms of clinical features, I know there's many, many causes of shock, but in terms of a syndrome, are there particular things that you see in your patients with shock that they present with?
Yeah, look, so you might there's a very large continuum of how shock will present. You might get the unconscious patient who is mottled, cyanotic, who can't really give you a history and whose vital signs are looking terrible, to someone who's not feeling that well, vital signs are okay, they might be a little bit tachycardic, but they're probably on the verge of falling off a cliff. So the really important part where you can is to gather as much history as possible. And I think in medicine, you know, history is really like the foundation to what you're going to do with the patient. So, you know, if your patient's able to talk, like you need to find out, have there been any trauma? So is there any, have you been in a car accident? Have you been in whatever else? And you're already going to know that because ambulance will bring this person in. But sometimes they may come in just feeling like rubbish and you might need to pick out that they had a car accident 6 hours ago or whatever else. Because if it's a traumatic event, then you might have a hemorrhagic event or things like tension pneumothoraces, which is going to be an obstructive type of shock. So that's going to be relevant. In the absence of that, you can work through things like there might be someone who's got vomiting or diarrhea. They might say, I've been vomiting blood, or I've had dark stools, or there's blood coming out of my rear end, in which case, again, you get a source of, you get an idea of where that might be coming from. Next thing, things like fever. You know, I've been shivering, I've been shaking, it burns when I pee. I've had diarrhea, I've had a cough or a cold, I've had this terrible skin rash, I've had a cut that, you know, happened a few weeks ago. I've been to some COVID country and got a cough. So all those things are important because then, you know, you might start thinking about septic shock.
Yeah.
So all that kind of history is important. In the event that you get someone with undifferentiated shock, your history is going to be much more limited, but gathering as much information as possible from where you can gives you a bit of an idea of where to go. So the clinical features are going to vary widely depending on the cause.
Okay.
But a person with shock is, you know, they're going to end up being quite terrible. But some of the things that you might find, like in parts of the history or in parts of the examination, might help you where to go. So, and again, there might be things like, oh, they got a fever. And if they got a fever, you might be thinking about septic shock then. So those kind of things are going to be relevant. The other things you'll think about also is their medical history itself. So, for example, if it's someone with a spinal cord injury, they might have a predisposition to urinary tract infections and things. So their medical history is going to be quite useful as well. So those are really the features. And then when you examine the patient, you can be guided by the history. But if it's undifferentiated, you know, you give them a pretty good look over, you look at the vital signs. So they could be anywhere from holding their vital signs perfectly normally with a bit of tachycardia because they're compensating for their shock in the early stages to being completely hypotensive, tachycardic, hypoxic, all that kind of stuff. And in your examination, you'd look, you know, you'd really just try to look for the source of what's going on.
Okay. So are there certain things that are pretty common, like, say, low urine output, the skin color / temperature? Yeah. Like, are those things accurate or not as much?
Yeah, so you can look for things like, modeled cold skin, cyanotic skin. They look gray, they look terrible. Low urine output, yes, because the kidneys aren't being perfused as well. Fevers, tachycardias, hypotension. So all those things.
Okay. All right, so then moving on to diagnostics. Do you have a number of investigations that you go to first? And what are you trying to do here? Are you trying to just diagnose shock is occurring, or are you trying to also understand what may be causing it, or possibly both of it?
Yeah, because you need to figure out the cause to really fix this person in the long term. But one of the things that's really quick and easy to do is a venous or arterial blood gas. So you can pull it off a patient. There's usually a machine in the ED or wherever you might be, and you run it through. And the main thing that you look for there is your lactate. So if the lactate is high and you're suspecting some sort of insult that's caused this person shock, that's really going to be quite useful. So the other things that you want to do, you know, almost everyone gets their basic full blood count. So the full blood count is going to tell you what their hemoglobin levels are. So if it's terribly low, you might start to think, oh, there's some sort of hemorrhagic event happening. You can also get a biochemistry panel. And the useful things there are, you know, you can check some of their end organ function, like the kidney function, and it might help you narrow down whether there's something else going on as well. So it gives you, you know, basic liver function and other things as well. But also electrolytes, so you can start to correct them if need be. But a majority of your investigations are going to be guided by what you suspect. So to give you an example, you know, someone, again, looking towards septic shock, some people that get it are febrile neutropenia. So if someone's had chemotherapy and they come in with fever and you find that in your full blood count that they're neutropenic, you start actually treating that straight away with antibiotics even before you get the full blood count back. And with those patients, you really need to go on a fishing trip. So you get a urine, you get a chest x-ray, you get sometimes you swab there. If they've got like a permanent long-term lining, sometimes they can get infected, so we swab that, and you just go on a fishing trip to find out where their source of infection is. If it's a trauma patient and they're significantly shocked, you can do a FAST scan. So it's a bedside scan that can look for evidence of intra-abdominal hemorrhage. But a lot of these patients go straight to the CT scanner to see what's going on inside their body. If it's someone that's had a history and risk factors for myocardial infarction that's going to end up in cardiogenic shock, then you think about, you know, your ECG is going to help, your cardiac biomarkers are going to help, and with these things. So a lot of these investigations are going to help you identify what it is. And you need to start treating that. There's no point in pumping fluids into someone who's got traumatic hemorrhagic shock because they're just leaking it into their belly. Okay. There's, and it's the same for, you know, if they're in cardiogenic shock, they might need urgent catheterization in a cardiac cath lab.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And if they're in septic shock,
Oh, no, finish off with your septic shock and then I'll ask you a question.
With septic shock, for example, like in people that have immunosuppressed, like febrile neutropenia, we start antibiotics almost immediately because that's going to fix the problem. So the investigation should be guided by what you suspect and who comes in.
Okay. And would there be any diagnostics that would also give you a good indication of how severe their shock is, or like in terms of the stage they're in? Like, would it be telling you that they're approaching, let's say, a decompensated state, or maybe even coming towards an irreversible? Would you, could you get that indication from any kind of investigation?
I think the main thing that you're going to look for really is like biochemistry panel can give you an indication of the end organ function, so how their kidneys are doing, and how all those things are doing. The lactate is going to give you, you know, it's going to tell you that they're in anaerobic respiration.
Yep.
But it's really the broad clinical picture. So that if they're, you know, if they're not responsive, if their GCS is really low, then you know that their brain's not really getting perfused.
Okay.
So you look at the broad picture. And if they're oliguric, like not making urine, you know that the kidneys are. So it's really looking at that broad picture.
Yeah, okay. So when they, just as a side question, when they, you hear the terms, you know, a person's gone into like a multi-organ failure, that's just basically doing these things like kidney function tests, looking at the heart, GCS, liver function tests, and if all of these are indicating that these organs aren't doing well, is that just telling you that they're in a multi kind of organ state of dysfunction?
Yeah, the organs are getting poorly perfused.
Yeah.
And they're quite intriguing.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Last question I just wanted to go through. I know you've just come off a night shift, so I need to get you to bed. But in terms of management, how, what guides you here? Is it, again, the kind of severity of the shock they're in, or is it looking for causes? How do you approach it?
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, broadly, for a lot of types of shock, fluid resuscitation is the main thing, particularly when you're looking at septic shock or hemorrhagic shock or whatever else. So fluid resuscitation, and sometimes aggressively so. There is some research happening that says that you should be a bit more cautious with fluid resuscitation and use vasopressors. So vasopressors change your vascular tone to yep. bring your blood pressure up as well.
Yep.
But really you're trying to normalize those vital signs by replacing volume and by using vasopressors if you're not really succeeding with just volume resuscitation alone. But some of the evidence around that might be changing, where they're saying early vasopressors might be better.
Okay. And What governs the type of fluid that you use?
So again, there's been some controversy around what kind of fluids that you use. You know, if someone's in hemorrhagic shock and their hemoglobin's terrible and they're bleeding, you're going to need to give them some blood transfusions. There's a bit of evidence emerging that fluids like Hartmann's might be better for shock broadly, and septic shock at least. So it's been a bit of a controversial area on that. But yeah, a lot of the current textbooks and literature says crystalloids, which is like normal saline or Hartmann's or whatever else, is generally what they recommend. But yeah, you might need to replace the actual blood as well.
Right.
So the other thing you generally need to start managing, particularly if they're quite shocked and they're not responding and their GCS is very low, is the airway.
Okay.
So airway management is the next thing, and you might be looking at intubating these people. Intubation is there are some agents that you use to intubate people that can cause hypotension, so they're careful not to use those agents.
Okay.
The other thing is, you know, one of the big users of oxygen is actually, you know, if they're tachyneic, so if they're breathing really fast, their respiratory muscles are using oxygen as well, and it's quite a big user of oxygen.
Yeah.
So getting control of that and slowing that down can actually reduce oxygen demand in the body. But airway management is one, volume resuscitation is the other. And then sorting out the cause.
Yeah, right. So with your vasopressors or inotropes, again, do you have usually a one go-to first, or does it again depend on what's kind of happening?
Yeah, it depends on hospital guidelines and what the centre suggests, but things like adrenaline infusions are used.
Yep.
To do it. Yeah.
So I can understand, say, with distribution shock, where you've got a lot of vasodilation and so forth, and you therefore giving them vasopressors makes sense to constrict it all up, and then, say, for hypovolemic shock, getting fluid back in. But if you have a patient in cardiogenic shock, where obviously perfusion is the issue both to the heart and also to the whole body, how do you manage this without making the heart work harder?
That's actually a really good point. So, and that's the thing, like you need to think about what you're doing sometimes. Even, actually, it's also a good point with spinal cord injury, because spinal cord injury in the acute stages causes, type of neurogenic shock because there's increased vagal tone. And for that, for a lot of this stuff, you can be pumping in a bunch of fluids, but until you start to get control of what's actually happening, it you may not be, you may not start to win.
Mm. All right. And then I guess a final side question just to finish off. If you were going to give, advice to students learning about shock, what kind of things would you tell them, encourage them with, hopefully get them to learn?
Yeah, I think broadly when you're thinking about medicine and whatever, just try to remember that, one of the biggest things that I remember from when I was a medical student was I was doing a ward round with a kidney specialist, and we saw this patient who was actually septic and had heart failure as well. Wow. And he asked me what I would do, and I just said, oh, fluid resuscitation. And he said, oh, well, you probably just killed this patient considering how bad his heart failure is. So.
Yeah.
He wasn't that sick with his sepsis at that point, but the lesson was that he actually just said, you have a brain to think about what you're doing, so always think about what you're doing. So I guess my advice would be to, that there are plenty of guidelines and there's plenty of literature and whatever else, but you actually, one of the biggest skills that you have to do is to really think about what you're doing and to consider all the different things that are going on with the patient. Think about their comorbidities and whatever else. Understand that there's, always think back to your physiology as well, because like you very rightly said, some interventions may not work in some clinical situations. So when you work back to the physiology and think about it, you'll actually question yourself and go, oh, is this actually going to work? So those basics are really important. Things like septic shock, they have a really high mortality rate. So recognizing it early, and there's been so much work done around the early recognition of sepsis and all these other things. So recognizing it early and starting to manage it early and getting the senior support you need early is very important as well. But yeah, I think just working your way from the basics and really critically thinking about stuff is probably the greatest piece of advice that I ever got.
Great. Well, thanks for your time. And I know you've, as I said, you've just come off a night shift. So I really appreciate you giving up your sleep for this. But I'm sure that everyone, all the listeners, appreciate your clinical input.
Nah.
And so it's already a long podcast, so I didn't want to keep you too long.
Hey, man, I always love spending time with you guys. So
yeah,
it's an honor.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. We had a lot of fun doing shock. It's a lot of stuff. I did a video on it on YouTube if you want to watch it. It doesn't go for this long. It goes for about 10 minutes, but I think I did a pretty good job of going through the different types of shock. Plus, I have a spectacular mustache in that
video. Yeah, it looks strange video. When you watch.
Yeah, I know. Look it looks fake, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it looks like I'm wearing a fake mustache, but it wasn't. So everyone, if you want to contact us, please do. You can send us an email, gubiosciences@gmail.com. I'm on Instagram putting up videos and chatting at Dr. Mike Todorovic, DrMiketodorovic. And we're both on Twitter. Just look for Matt Barton and Mike Todorovic and you'll find us on Twitter because I always forget our Twitter handle. I got rid of Facebook. So we don't have a Facebook page, but Dr. Mike has a Facebook page. So come have a chat. All right, everybody. Matt, thanks, mate.
See you, Mike.
See you, guys.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.